Morning.
We're here this morning on the case of Commonwealth versus Morrissey. Mr. Anderson, are you prepared to begin?
I hope so, Your Honor.
Okay, you have 15 minutes. Would you like any time for rebuttal?
I'll take three, if I could.
Okay, thank you. You may proceed.
Imagine, if you will, a plea hearing in which the parties offer the following provision in that agreement. Quote, in addition to the agreement disposing of the charges arising out of conduct occurring 16 months ago, the Commonwealth agrees not to prosecute the defendant for any crimes committed before or during the plea hearing in an effort to obtain the court's approval of the agreement and the agreed-upon sentence. This agreement extends to such new crimes, irrespective of whether the Commonwealth had knowledge of or reasonable grounds to suspect such offenses. I submit that if a circuit court was confronted with that kind of language, it would surely reject it out of hand and say, are you serious? Of course we're not going to...
Mr. Anderson, while that may be, we are stuck with the agreement that we have, and my first question to you is, do we even have jurisdiction to entertain the appeal?
Yes, sir. I think we do. The lower court explicitly based its ruling granting the motion to dismiss on two grounds. One was essentially contractual, that the paragraph 9 in the plea agreement, which is a very lengthy agreement, by the way, and it wasn't just we agreed to do this, you agreed to do that. There was much more than that. But in any event, the court explicitly based it both on contractual grounds and double jeopardy. And by the way, the appellee says that he's not asserting that there's a double jeopardy violation in this case. Well, I counted it up yesterday, and in relatively brief argument, counsel used the word jeopardy 7 times in that argument. That certainly sounds like a double jeopardy claim to me, and most of those times he talked about jeopardy attaching.
But wasn't that in specific reference to whether the terms of the plea agreement were binding on all the parties? That the plea agreement did not become binding until jeopardy attached.
But his argument, as I understand it, was that anything and everything that at least in one way or another related to these kinds of crimes that had occurred as of the time of the court accepting the plea agreement, which at that point they said jeopardy attached, that everything up to that point, including any new offenses, was part and parcel of the disposition of the case. If that's true, if jeopardy attached, as counsel repeatedly argued, then obviously double jeopardy would bar a later prosecution on those offenses.
If we accept for a moment that there are two elements and one constitutional, can we reach the constitutional one if we cannot reach the purely contractual one?
I think the answer is yes. Let me point out one thing which I think has some significance here, which is, I don't frankly recall whether the appellee filed a brief in opposition in this court, but he certainly filed a motion to dismiss the appeal as jurisdictionally barred and made essentially identical arguments to the arguments he's advanced jurisdictionally in his brief. To wit, he says, and part of what he says is there's no question that he's correct. Double jeopardy is plainly an appealable ground for the Commonwealth for a pretrial appeal.
Well, in Commonwealth versus Rogers, dealing with A2 of the statute, not A1, I grant you, this court found that a trial court's dismissal of indictment based on an evidentiary ruling based on collateral estoppel was not reviewable by this court, even if it raised double jeopardy concerns. So it seems to me that what we've said previously is if there's an independent ground that does not fall within the statute, we can't reach it.
Well, double jeopardy concerns is different than double jeopardy as an explicit basis for granting the motion to dismiss. This is my primary argument, and if the court agrees with me, then we get to the merits. If it doesn't, then we probably don't. You have two separate grounds here, and I think there's no dispute about the fact that double jeopardy had been the only articulated basis for the granting the motion to dismiss that would plainly be something this court could consider by way of a Commonwealth pretrial appeal. It's equally clear that if the only basis for the lower court's dismissal was this essentially contractual notion that the plea agreement terms, as a sort of a contractual matter, prohibited the new indictments and prosecution on them. If that was the only stated ground, then we'd be out of luck, and I doubt very seriously if a petition for appeal would have been filed. But that's not what we have. We have two grounds here, and I submit, as I've said in my brief, that they are inextricably linked. The double jeopardy ruling is entirely driven by the contractual ruling, which is to say, if there was no agreement one way or the other about these new offenses that were occurring right under the nose of the judge and the Commonwealth at the plea hearing, if they were not part of the mix in that plea agreement, then plainly there's no double jeopardy issue. By the same token, if counsel's repeated arguments that jeopardy attached was correct, then plainly there would be a double jeopardy problem. But the point is, you cannot reasonably decide the double jeopardy issue without deciding the contractual issue. I say they're inextricably linked. Counsel's reply brief referred to that, but sure didn't show how that argument is wrong. I invite him today to explain how this court, could decide the double jeopardy issue in an entirely discrete fashion without getting in to the contractual issue. I submit
doesn't that have it backwards? If we decided on the constitutional avoidance dictates that we don't answer the constitutional question until we have answered all statutory questions, don't you have a statutory problem with us exercising jurisdiction? Where in 19.2.398A1 does it say that we can interpret immunity agreements? Or we can review a circuit court's review of what the parties characterized as an immunity provision below in a Commonwealth's appeal?
What I'm saying is the double jeopardy issue, which in and of itself is reviewable, there is no possible way to decide it without getting in to the other issue. I submit that there is a sufficient heavy overlap between the two, sufficient to provide the court's jurisdiction. I do have one additional argument on that, and then if I could go to the merits. This case is unusual in one respect. As I say, there was a motion to dismiss the appeal filed by the defendant, and as I say, I don't recall a brief in opposition was filed, but it doesn't matter for this argument. And that motion to dismiss the appeal made exactly, in essence, the same arguments that were broached in the opening brief. And this court, a month later, awarded an appeal despite that motion. I'm not saying that, which to me is a tacit denial or rejection of that motion. I'm not saying the court is absolutely bound by that ruling, but what I am saying, and I'm not submitting that it's technically the law of the case, but it surely counts for something. It surely, I would submit that it's up to the defendant to come up with something different or better as to why there's no jurisdiction here, but he just made the same argument. Well, I cited a case.
Well, couldn't the answer simply be that we wanted to give the parties a full opportunity to brief the jurisdictional issue?
Well, that could be, but to me, judicial economy would basically be undermined by a situation where there's a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, and then we go through all of the efforts involved in briefing and arguing the case. Again, I'm not saying that ruling is something you can't revisit. That's not my position. I'm saying it counts for something. I cited a Fourth Circuit case that quoted a U.S. Supreme Court case and basically said that absent extraordinary circumstances, a court should be loath to revisit, i.e., back away from its prior decisions. I'm simply saying, under these circumstances, it should count for something. Now, if I could, on the merits, I think the merits is heavily in the Commonwealth's favor, which I suppose is why the defendant's brief is not exactly extensive on the merits, and it doesn't respond to all sorts of points in the Commonwealth's opening brief. such as, for example, they look solely at paragraph 9 of the agreement. By the way, as I pointed out in my brief, by mistake, there are two paragraphs, 9s. But the paragraph 9 that has the language that the Commonwealth agreed to, quote, withhold any other potential criminal charges against the defendant, such as conspiracy to suborn perjury, conspiracy to obstruct justice, etc. I submit that only the most hyper-technical, rigidly formalistic view that entirely ignores the context in which the negotiations were going forth could come up with the construction that the lower court came here. They want to focus solely on paragraph 9, but a contract, by definition, you look at all, it's like statutory construction. You look at the whole package to see what is the reasonable what the parties in fact, the meeting of the minds, what they reasonably understood. And counsel, it's interesting, at the hearing on the motion to dismiss, he says at one point, well, I can understand the Commonwealth might be upset or can be upset by basically the pending demise of these charges. Well, if there was a meeting of the minds, if the parties knew exactly how this would play out, what's the Commonwealth to be upset about?
Counsel, let me just interrupt you because I'm still concerned about the jurisdictional piece. And if we were to get to the merits of this case, I think, you know, some of your arguments are very well taken. But I'm still struggling with a circuit court that essentially said at the very end, well, I'm going to throw double jeopardy in just so that this gets heard by the Court of Appeals.
Well,
isn't that essentially what he did?
Well, I might quibble a little bit with that, but that's not, even under my view, that's not terribly different than what happened. I would say several things in response. The defense counsel could have objected and said, this has nothing to do with double jeopardy, despite my 7 prior references to jeopardy attaching. Ignore what I've just said. This is not a double jeopardy case, and you should not do that. Or he could have said, no, that's just a transparent vehicle for appellate review. The fact is, irrespective of his motivation, the judge explicitly based the ruling in part on double jeopardy grounds. And again, if, as defense counsel asserted, the jeopardy was attaching when the court accepted the plea agreement, then by definition, if that's true, then these other if these charges are part and parcel of the plea agreement, then obviously under double jeopardy you could not have a subsequent prosecution. I'm losing part of my rebuttal time. I was going to make...
You know, Mr. Anderson, we'll give you a little bit more time on rebuttal since I took up some of your rebuttal time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, good morning. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Anthony Troy on behalf of the appellee. A couple things. One, with regard to jurisdiction, I think as this court knows, that issue can be raised at any time, at any point. So the suggestion that because it was raised by us and we're here before you, that jurisdiction is waived, that is simply contrary to years and hundreds of years of case law. Secondly, the issue of double jeopardy. The statute allows a review for any decision by a court which determined that the defendant was twice placed in jeopardy. The Commonwealth has set out exactly the standards of double jeopardy. Judge Atlee, in his recent, Johnson decision, set out double jeopardy. Was there a previous acquittal? Was there a previous conviction? I did not argue double jeopardy. I could not argue double jeopardy below There was no previous acquittal. There was no previous conviction of Mr. Morrissey on these charges.
Counsel, if you didn't argue it, how did the trial court end up ruling on it?
Your Honor, as you said, I understand the basis of his ruling. This is a public official. It's a high-profile situation. The original case, what we call Morrissey 1, had high-profile visibility. And I believe Judge Swirsky felt that someone other than he as a trial judge should review things. However, as we know, a judge, I cannot, you cannot, a judge cannot create jurisdiction where jurisdiction does not exist. And so the issue of double jeopardy should not be confused, which I did not argue, should not be confused with the determination of when jeopardy attaches in a plea agreement. And so when I was arguing about when jeopardy attaches and talking about the various case laws regarding when jeopardy attaches, I was pointing out the longstanding case law in this Commonwealth as well as federal case law that in a bench trial, jeopardy does not attach until the court accepts the plea.
Well, and that gets to the merits of it. And my understanding of the agreement, at least as it's presented in the record, is that it would have been a violation, a breach of the agreement. In fact, a material breach of the agreement if at the plea hearing your client, through you or through himself, had stood up and said, I want a stars disposition. I want a delayed disposition. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Then doesn't, at least, and that's paragraph 7, or one of the subparagraphs in paragraph 7, doesn't that at least assume that some, if not all, of the two parties' obligations, setting aside the court accepting it, had to be accomplished prior to the court accepting the plea? Because you've told me it's a breach, but you've told me it doesn't exist until the court accepts the plea. Well, how could asking for a deferred disposition before the plea was accepted be a breach if there's no agreement?
There would have been no agreement if...
Well, how do you breach an agreement that doesn't exist?
Well, it would simply have been taken, and any ability to reach an agreement would have been taken off the table. The question really is...
But the parties actually phrased it as a material breach of this agreement.
Yes, sir, I understand.
So doesn't that suggest that the parties thought that they had an agreement pending the court's approval?
Pending the court's acceptance. And all I'm saying is that the standard case law, which the Commonwealth does not dispute, is that an agreement takes effect only once the judge accepts the agreement. As Judge Swirsky said in his rulings, and it was, quote, as our Supreme Court, and I'm quoting from page 282 of the appendix, as our Supreme Court has said many times, until accepted by the judge, it is just words on a piece of paper. And the case law is...
Although binding both of the parties in front of that judge.
Well, up until the time it was accepted by the judge, Mr. Morrissey could have changed his mind and said, I'm not pleading, offered, or anything. I'm walking out of this courtroom. And there would have been no consequences to him other than to be put back where we were. So there was no agreement, quote unquote, in that sense. The agreement that took place was that as soon as he pled that offered plea and it was accepted, he was going to be handcuffed and go directly to jail for 6 months. That was part of the agreement that was of great importance to the Commonwealth.
If we reach the merits and we review it and we find that because of language like in paragraph 7 that the agreement could be breached prior to there being an agreement, if we follow your argument, and we find that renders it ambiguous as to what the parties intended, do we have to remand for parole evidence? Would that be an appropriate resolution?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because really the essence of the agreement that we're talking about is in paragraph 9. And as Judge Swirsky said, again, on page 283 of the appendix, I do not believe that provision, meaning paragraph 9, is ambiguous. And under those circumstances, under contract law, not double jeopardy law, contract law, parole evidence would not be permitted. And under standard contract law, of course, as we all know, parole evidence is not allowed unless there's ambiguity. Well, parole evidence cannot be put in to create ambiguity.
Isn't there some ambiguity in the term any other potential criminal charges when you yourself concede it doesn't mean literally any other potential criminal charges? I believe the example at trial was murder. If he had murdered two witnesses before the plea hearing that day,
correct.
You have conceded below that that's not covered by the plea agreement. If any other potential criminal charges literally means any other potential criminal charges, why is that so? Doesn't that render it ambiguous in and of itself?
In the context of this case, in the context of Judge Swirsky's findings and rulings on contract law, he found two things. One, clear and unambiguous, encompassing the crimes that were charged. Not murder, not other stray crimes, that the crimes that were involved. And then he went on and secondly found that even if the language didn't encompass that, that the charges that Mr. Morsi faced were already past crimes that were committed. And then he applied the standard concept of when does a plea agreement become effective?
But the interpretation of the contract, it doesn't really matter for appellate purposes what Judge Swirsky found, correct? It's a de novo review here, correct? On the question of ambiguity, that's a call for us to make in the first instance.
Well, yes. But as Judge Swirsky said, as the language says, it couldn't be clearer. Any and all other types of crimes, etc., potential crimes. Not possible crimes, but potential.
Well, if that's true, how come it's not a fraudulent contract to begin with? If you're taking your language and that it's clear, how can anybody say that that's a legitimate agreement?
Well, because it was entered into with at arm's length willing, the Commonwealth was willing to enter into this to end this matter once and for all. Secondly, of course, in order to reach respectfully the answer to Your Honor's question, you have to assume that the legislature has granted jurisdiction to this
court. Understood.
If we were to conclude or assume, I'll ask you the hypothetical, assuming your client entered into this contract with the express intention to commit a fraud on the court at the plea hearing, would that contract be void as against public policy?
Well, of course, that's a hard predicate to accept in the first place. But
accepting
the answer, as hard as the answer is, Your Honor, the answer is that if the contract law, if under contract law, the language encompasses the activity involved and could have been contemplated to encompass the activity involved, then it's not a fraud, that it's part of the bargaining. And even if the other side says, I never intended that, the question is not what did they intend, it's what did they say. And what they intended is what they put in writing.
But, of course, that can't mean that it bars any potential crime because you've already conceded it doesn't bar any
murder.
Potential crime.
Right. But when you read the language involved, obviously, which is to withhold any other potential criminal charges against the defendant, such as conspiracy to suborn perjury, conspiracy to obstruct justice, etc., any other potential criminal charges such as, I think a fair reading of that is that if Mr. Morrissey had pulled a gun in front of somebody, we recreate Hillsville, if maybe I'm the only one old enough to remember Hillsville, that would not have been encompassed in this language. What is encompassed is any other potential criminal charges, such as conspiracy to suborn perjury, conspiracy to obstruct justice, etc. And so the
Commonwealth... That in and of itself is kind of curious, isn't it, counsel, that those specific crimes would be outlined in it?
Pretty broad.
How about forgery and uttering? That's not in that list. And forging and uttering, I don't tend to think of those as of a kind of suborning perjury. Now, obviously, in the context in which the charge arose, it's to obstruct justice, but just because...
Well, the context of the subordination here was part and parcel of perjury, that there was a subordination of a false document that Mr. Morsi purportedly had another witness testify to. She was acquitted, by the way, of any such charges. But
that's not material for our resolution.
But
today, is it?
Correct. But the Commonwealth, seven times in its briefs, admits that Judge Sworsky's decision was on two different grounds. Seven times. And then on page 3 of their reply brief, they invite this court to, quote, first determine the contract-based ruling. They even admit in the oral argument that you must first determine the contract-based ruling in order to then proceed to anything about double jeopardy, which, by the way, I'd never argued. So they're inviting you to review something that the legislature has not stated. And again, the recent decision by Judge Attlee in the Johnson matter, this court knows that the legislature says what it means and means what it says. And it did not invite anything other than that. Again, I know why Judge Sworsky did what he did. I can't fault him. It was a high-profile matter, but does not respectfully allow jurisdiction for this court to first determine a contract ruling, which is contract-based. And if you read pages 280 to 282 the appendix, it's clear that Judge Sworsky was ruling first on contract.
Counsel, the circuit court can no more confer jurisdiction on this court than we can.
Correct. I understand that. And my point is that when you read pages 280, 281, 282, the plea agreement must be measured first in terms of contract law. It is plain. It is unambiguous. I give their words their normal, natural meaning. Then he goes on to say that I don't believe this provision in the plea agreement covers just past crimes. It could have been more specifically limited to say only those crimes which the Commonwealth has knowledge at this time, and the language is not there. He goes on and on to point out all these contract principles, makes a determination, whether it's erroneous or not, this court said in Brown, that's not the legislature's decision to allow us to determine that. And then goes on to say, I honestly believe this matter, if it can, should be heard by the Court of Appeals and not limited to the trial court.
What is your position as to who drafted, not the agreement in toto, but the second paragraph 9, the one that includes the immunity provision? Which party to the agreement drafted that?
Both parties drafted the entire agreement, and both parties were satisfied. I would, outside the record, I will tell you that the prosecutor in this case was glad to have this matter behind him, felt that the state bar would be involved,
but
and that's what he wanted.
Obviously, the purpose of my question is sometimes provisions are against the drafter, and you're saying there was no drafter singular.
It cannot be, we being Mr. Armstrong and I, counsel, did not take responsibility to draft this. We are not the principal drafters. There should be no inference one way or the other.
Thank you, counsel.
I would say, if anything, the inference is these things are strictly construed against the Commonwealth. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Anderson, we're going to go ahead and give you your rebuttal time.
Do I get any additional time or my 149?
It's 149, I'll talk quick.
No, go ahead and give him his full time. If you,
my 3 minutes?
Yeah, if we can figure out how to do that, I'm sure we can.
Give us
a minute. No, I've heard about your watch.
I'm very adept with
Mr. Anderson, I've heard about your watch. Don't worry about it. She's got you covered.
I don't have a Casio anymore.
Go ahead.
So.
Go ahead.
All right. Let me talk fast because I could probably be up here 30 minutes responding to various points. Counsel keeps saying he did not argue double jeopardy at the plea hearing. I think the answer to that is plainly that he did. He said that there weren't any prior actions talking about the constitutional guarantees, but the whole point is, if he's correct, then these new charges that were occurring just as all this was transpiring, they were part and parcel of the disposition of the case. Jeopardy had attached to them, so there could be no future proceeding. That's a double jeopardy claim. It's also interesting that he argued both at trial and on brief that basically anything, the jeopardy attached in a guilty plea case when the court accepted the plea agreement. He said anything after that, fair game. Well, in this particular case, there was the acceptance of the plea was prior to the imposition of the sentence. So conspiracy, for example, and I cited in my reply brief, is a continuing offense. So conspiracy was continuing even after the acceptance of the plea. So even by his own precepts, it's fair game. Let me get on to several other things.
But conspiracy was chargeable the minute there was an agreement and an overt act, right?
Well, the conspiracy is the agreement, but it's a continuing offense. Then Your Honor asked, I thought it was a pretty straightforward question, if we conclude that the term at issue is ambiguous, can we or should we send it back to remand for a remand to consider the parole evidence that the Commonwealth proffered? And I don't think counsel ever answered the question. I think the answer plainly is yes. If the court concludes that this language is ambiguous, and frankly, from the Commonwealth's viewpoint, I don't see how it could, either it's unambiguous in our favor, or at worst, it's ambiguous. If that's true, then the disposition of the case in this court is quite clear under some cases I've cited, or you remand for a consideration of the heretofore excluded parole evidence. If I understood counsel's argument, he said if these new crimes could be contemplated, then they're part of the bargain. That is one of the more egregious things in this case. It was just, I don't think Nostradamus could have contemplated these offenses. Look, context.
Mr. Anderson, turning to the drafting of the agreement, would your reading essentially is that anything that had, any of these potential crimes that had occurred prior to the plea hearing that morning, when the two parties, setting aside the court for a moment, struck its agreement. So wouldn't it have been easy for the Commonwealth to say before this date and stick a date in there?
Well, 2 points. One about who did the drafting, and second about just how extraordinary this turn of events was. Could not possibly be anticipated. Look at the defendant. The defendant was an attorney. He's an elected official. Former Commonwealth attorney for the city of Richmond, had been disbarred and then had his license reinstated, and you would think that the notion of Caesar's wife would be right at the top of the list of do everything to avoid any...
Doesn't that suggest that the Commonwealth was on notice?
I think that accords any Commonwealth attorney. I don't know if Charles Dickens or Stephen King has the ability to imagine what happened here. This defendant is getting a very favorable plea agreement where the four felonies go bye-bye, even though there's, according to the Commonwealth summary of his evidence, it's very strong. It's a very favorable plea agreement. There's a sentencing disposition, and yet he does what he does according to the Commonwealth's charges. So I don't see how it could possibly, in any realistic way, have been anticipated. If the Commonwealth...
If
the Commonwealth is required to have that level of imagination, then I think there will be many times the Commonwealth is found wanting. I'd ask the court to conclude it has jurisdiction and either find the term was unambiguous and send it back for trial, or at the worst, find it's ambiguous and send it back for consideration of parole evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. As tradition for the court, we'll come down.